I know you did. I found them in your room when I was there with Cham. He looked startled. You said nothing to me about it. At first I was angry, she admitted. But that was the night we found you in the Ifrit den. I felt for you, I suppose. I told myself you had only been curious or Charlotte had asked you to read them. She didn't, he said. I pulled them out of the fire myself. I read them all, every word you wrote, and you and I, Tess, we're alike. We live and breathe words. It was books that kept me from taking my own life, after I thought I could never love anyone, never be loved by anyone again. It was books that made me feel that perhaps I was not completely alone. They could be honest with me, and I with them. Reading your words, what you wrote, how you were lonely sometimes and afraid, but always brave, the way you saw the world, its colors and its textures and sounds, I felt the way you thought, hoped, felt, dreamed. I felt I was dreaming and thinking and feeling with you. I dreamed what you dreamed, wanted what you wanted, and then I realized that truly, I just wanted you. The girl behind the scrawled letters. I loved you from the moment I read them. I love you still. Tessa had begun to tremble. This was what she had always wanted someone to say. What she had always, in the darkest corner of her heart, wanted Will to say. Will, the boy who loved the same books she did, the same poetry she did, who made her laugh even when she was furious. And here he was, standing in front of her, telling her he loved the words of her heart, the shape of her soul, telling her something she had never imagined anyone would ever tell her, telling her something she would never be told again, not in this way, and not by him. And it did not matter. It's too late, she said. Don't say that. His voice was half a whisper. I love you, Tessa. I love you. She shook her head. Will, stop. He took a ragged breath. I knew you would be reluctant to trust me, he said. Tessa, please. Is it that you do not believe me, or is it that you cannot imagine ever loving me back? Because if it's the second... Will, it doesn't matter. Nothing matters more. His voice grew in strength. I know that if you hate me, it is because I forced you to. I know that you have no reason to give me a second chance to be regarded by you in a different light. But I am begging you for that chance. I will do anything, anything. His voice cracked, and she heard the echo of another voice inside it. She saw Jem looking down at her, all the love and light and hope and expectancy in the world caught up in his eyes. No, she whispered. It isn't possible. It is, he said desperately. It must be. You cannot hate me as much as all that. I don't hate you at all, she said with great sadness. I tried to hate you well, but I can never manage it. Then there's a chance. Hope fled in his eyes. She should not have spoken so gently. Oh, God, was there nothing that would make this less awful? She had to tell him. Now, quickly. Cleanly. Tessa, if you don't hate me, then there's a chance that you might... Jem has proposed to me, she blurted out. And I have said yes. What? I said that Jem proposed to me, she whispered. He asked if I would marry him, and I said I would. Will had gone shockingly white. He said, Jem. My... Jem. She nodded, without words to say. Will staggered and put his hand on the back of a chair for balance. He looked like someone who had been suddenly viciously kicked in the stomach. When? This morning. But we have been growing closer, much closer for a long time. You and Jem. Will looked as if he were being asked to believe in something impossible. Snow in summertime, a London winter without rain. In answer, Tessa touched with her fingertips the jade pendant Jem had given her. He gave me this, she said. Her voice was very quiet. It was his mother's bridal gift. Will stared at it, at the Chinese characters on it, as if it were a serpent curled about her throat. He never told me anything. He never said a word about you to me. Not that way. He pushed his hair back from his face, that characteristic gesture she had seen him make 1,000 times, only now his hand was visibly shaking. Do you love him? Yes, I love him, she said, and she saw Will flinch. Don't you? But he would understand, he said dazedly. If we explained it to him, if we told him, he would understand. For a moment, Tessa imagined herself drawing the pendant off, going down the hallway, knocking on Jem's door, giving it back to him, telling him she had made a mistake, that she could not marry him. She could tell him everything about herself and about Will. How she was not sure, how she needed time, how she could not promise him all of her heart, how some part of her belonged to Will and always would. And then she thought of the first words she had ever heard Jem speak. His eyes closed, his back to her, his face to the moonlight. Will? Will, is that you? The way Will's voice, his face, softened for Jem, as it did for no one else. The way Jem had gripped Will's hands in the infirmary while he bled. The way Will had called out, James! When the warehouse automaton had knocked Jem down. I cannot sever them, one from another, she thought. I cannot be responsible for such a thing. I cannot tell either of them the truth. She imagined Jem's face if she called off the engagement. He would be kind. Jem was always kind. But she would be breaking something precious inside him, something essential. He would not be the same afterward, and there would be no Will to comfort him. And he had so little time. And Will, what would he do then? Whatever he might think now, she knew that if she broke things off with Jem, even then, he would not touch her, would not be with her, no matter how much he loved her. How could he parade his love for her in front of Jem, knowing his happiness came at the cost of his best friend's pain? Even if Will told himself he could manage it, to him she would always be the girl Jem loved, until the day Jem died. Until the day she died. He would not betray Jem, even after death. If it had been anyone else in the world. But she did not love anyone else in the world. These were the boys she loved, for better and for worse. She made her voice as cold as she could, as calm. Told him what? Will only looked at her. There had been light in his eyes on the stairs as he'd locked the door. When he'd kissed her, a brilliant, joyous light. And it was going now, fading like the last breath of someone dying. She thought of Nate bleeding to death in her arms. She had been powerless then to help him, as she was now. She felt as if she were watching the life bleed out of Will Herondale, and there was nothing she could do to stop it. Jem would forgive me, Will said, but there was a hopelessness in his face, his voice, already. He had given up. Tessa thought. Will, who never gave up on any fight before it had started. He would, she said. He could never stay angry at you, Will. He loves you too well for that. I do not even think he would hold anger toward me. But this morning he told me he thought he would die without ever loving anyone as his father loved his mother, without ever being loved like that in return. Do you want me to go down that hallway and knock on his door and take that away from him? I mean, do you love me still, if I did? Will looks at her for a long moment. Then he seemed to crumple inside, like paper. He sat down in the armchair and put his face into his hands. You promised me, he said, that you love him, enough to marry him and make him happy. Yes, she said. Then, if you love him, he said quietly. Please, Tessa, don't tell him what I just told you. Don't tell him that I love you. And the curse? He doesn't know? Please don't tell him about that either. Nor Henry, nor Charlotte, no one. I must tell them in my own time, in my own way. Pretend I said nothing to you, If you care about me at all, Tessa. I will tell no one, she said. I swear it, I promise it, on my angel, my mother's angel. And, well, he had lowered his hands, but he still could not seem to look at her. He was gripping the sides of the armchair, his knuckles white. I think you had better go, Tessa. But she could not bear to. Not when he was looking like that, like he was dying on the inside. More than anything else, she wanted to go and put her arms around him, to kiss his eyes closed, to make him smile again. What you have endured, she said, since you were 12 years old, it would have killed most people. You have always believed that no one loved you, that no one could love you, as their continued survival was proof to you that they did not. But Charlotte loves you, and Henry, and Jim, and your family. They all have always loved you, Will Herondale, for you cannot hide what is good about yourself, however hard you try. He lifted his head and looked at her. She saw the flame of the fire reflected in his blue eyes. And you, do you love me? Her nails dug into her palms. Will, she said. He looked at her, almost through her, blindly. Do you love me? She took a deep breath. It hurt. Jem has been right about you all this time. You were better than I gave you credit for being, and for that I am sorry. Because if this is you, what you are truly like, and I think that it is, that you will have no difficulty finding someone to love you, Will. Someone for whom you come first in their heart. But I... He made a sound halfway between a choking laugh and a gasp. First in your heart, he said. Would you believe that is not the only time you have said that to me? She shook her head, bewildered. Well, I have not. You can never love me, he said flatly. And when she did not respond, when she said nothing, he shuddered. A shudder that ran through his whole body, and pushed away from the armchair without looking at her. He stood up stiffly and crossed the room, groping for the bolt on the door. She watched with her hand across her mouth as, after what seemed like an age, he found it, fumbled it open, and went out into the corridor, slamming the door behind him. Will, she thought. Will, is that you? The backs of her eyes ached. Somehow she had found that she was sitting on the floor in front of the grate of the fire. She stared at the flames, waiting for tears to come. Nothing happened. After such a long time of forcing them back, it seemed, she had lost the ability to cry. She took the poker from the fireplace iron holder and drove the tip of it into the heart of the burning coals, feeling the heat on her face. The jade pendant around her throat warmed, almost burning her skin. She drew the poker out of the fire. It glowed as red as a heart. She closed her hand around the tip. For a moment, she felt absolutely nothing. And then, as if from a great distance, she heard herself cry out. And it was like a key turned inside her heart, freeing the tears at last. The poker clattered to the ground. When Sophie came dashing in, having heard her scream, she found Tessa on her knees by the fire, her burned hand pressed to her chest, sobbing as if her heart would break.
It was Sophie who took Tessa to her room, and Sophie who put her in her nightgown and then in bed, and Sophie who washed her burned hand with a cool flannel and bound it up with a salve that smelled like herbs and spices. The same salve, she told Tessa, that Charlotte had used on Sophie's cheek when she had first come to the Institute. "Do you think I'll have a scar?" Tessa asked, more out of curiosity than because she cared one way or the other. The burn, and the weeping that had followed it, seemed to have seared and flooded all the emotion out of her. She felt as light and hollow as a shell.
"Probably a bit of a one, not like I've got," said Sophie frankly, securing the bandage around Tessa's hand. "Burns hurt worse than they are. If you catch my meaning, and I got to you quickly with the salve, you'll be all right."
"No, I won't be," said Tessa, looking at her hand, and then over at Sophie. Sophie, lovely as always, calm and patient in her black dress and white cap, her curls clustering around her face. "I'm sorry again, Sophie," she said. "You were right about Gideon, and I was wrong. I should have listened to you. You're the last person on earth inclined to be foolish over men. The next time you say someone is worth trusting, I will believe you." Sophie's smile flashed out, the smile that made even strangers forget her scar.
"I understand why you said it.
I should have trusted you."
"I shouldn't have got so angry," Sophie said. "The truth is, I wasn't sure myself what he was going to do. I wasn't sure till he came back in the carriage with you all that he would side with us in the end."
"It must be nice, though," Tessa said, playing with the bedclothes, "that he's going to live here. He'll be so close to you."
"It will be the worst thing in the world," Sophie said, and suddenly her eyes were full of tears.
Tessa froze in horror, wondering what she could have said so wrong. The tears stood in Sophie's eyes without falling, making their green shimmer.
"If he lives here, he'll see me as I really am, a servant."
Her voice cracked.
"I knew I should never have gone to see him when he asked me. Mrs. Brownwell's not the type to punish her servants for having followers and the like, but I knew it was wrong anyway, because he's himself and I'm me, and we don't belong together."
She reached up a hand and wiped at her eyes, and then the tears did fall, spilling down both her cheeks, the whole and the scarred one.
"I could lose everything if I let myself. And what's he stand to lose? Nothing."
"Gideon's not like that."
"He's his father's son," Sophie said.
"Who says that doesn't matter? It's not as if he was going to marry a mundane as it was, but to see me building up his fire, doing the washing up. If he loves you, he won't mind all that."
"People always mind all that. They're not so noble as you think."
Tessa thought of Will, with his face in his hands, saying,
"If you love him, please, Tessa, don't tell him what I just told you."
One finds nobility in the oddest places, Soph. Besides, would you really want to be a shadow hunter? Wouldn't you rather...
"Oh, but I do want it," said Sophie. "More than anything in the world. I always have."
"I never knew," Tessa said, marveling.
"I used to think if I married Master Jem..."
Sophie picked at the blanket, then looked up and smiled bleakly.
"You haven't broken his heart yet, have you?"
"No," Tessa said. "Just torn my own in two." "I haven't broken his heart at all."
Chapter 21. Coals of Fire. "Oh, brother, the gods were good to you. Sleep, and be glad while the world endures. Be well content as the years wear through. Give thanks for life and the loves and lures. Give thanks for life, oh, brother, and death. For the sweet last sound of her feet, her breath. For gifts she gave you, gracious and few, tears and kisses, that lady of yours." Algernon Charles Swinburne. The Triumph of Time. Music poured out from under Jem's door, which was partly cracked open. Will stood with his hand on the knob, his shoulder against the wall. He felt profoundly exhausted, more tired than he had ever felt in his life. A terrible burning energy had kept him alert since he had left Cheyne Walk. But it was gone now, drained away, and there was only an exhausted darkness. He had waited for Tessa to call after him once he had slammed the drawing room door, but she had not. He could still see her, looking at him, with her eyes like great grey storm clouds. "Jem has proposed to me, and I have said yes." "Do you love him?" "I love him." And yet, here he was, standing in front of Jem's door. He did not know if he had come here to try to talk Jem out of Tessa, if such a thing could be accomplished, or, more likely, if this was where he had learned to go for comfort, and he could not unlearn the habit of years. He pushed the door open, Witchlight poured out into the hallway, and he stepped into Jem's room. Jem was sitting on the trunk at the foot of his bed, his violin balanced on his shoulder. His eyes were closed as the bow soared over the string, but the corners of his lips quirked up as his parabatai came into the room, and he said,
"Will, is that you, Will?"
"Yes," Will said. He was standing just inside the room, feeling as if he could go no further. Jem stopped playing and opened his eyes. "Tallyman," he said. "Fantasia in E-flat major." He set his violin and bow down.
"Well, come in then. You're making me nervous standing there."
Will took a few more steps inside. He had spent so much time in this room. He knew it as well as his own. Jem's collection of music books, the case in which his violin lived when he was not playing it, the windows that let in square patches of sunlight, the trunk that had come all the way from Shanghai, the cane with its jade top leaning against the wall, the box with Kuan Yin on it that held Jem's drugs, the armchair in which Will had spent countless nights watching Jem sleep, counting his breaths and praying. Jem looked up at him. His eyes were luminous. No suspicion colored them, only a simple happiness at seeing his friend. "I'm glad you're here."
"So am I," Will said gruffly.
He felt awkward and wondered if Jem could sense it. He had never felt awkward around his parabatai before. It was the words, he thought, there on the tip of his tongue, pleading to be said.
"You see it, don't you, James? Without Tessa, there is nothing for me. No joy. No light, no life. If you loved me, you would let me have her. You can't love her as I do. No one could. If you were truly my brother, you would do this for me."
But the words remained unspoken, and Jem leaned forward, his voice low and confiding.
"Will, there was something I wanted to say to you, and not when everyone else was around." Will braced himself. This was it. Jem was going to tell him about the engagement, and he was going to have to pretend to be happy and not be sick out the window, which he desperately wanted to be. He stuffed his hands into his pockets.
"And what's that?" The sun glittered off Jem's hair as he ducked his head.
"I should have talked to you before, but we never have discussed the subject of love, have we? And with you being such a cynic," he grinned, "I thought you'd mock me for it. Besides, I've never felt there was a chance she'd return my feelings."
"Tessa," said Will. Her name was like knives in his mouth. Jem's smile was luminous, lighting his whole face, and any hope that Will had harbored in some secret chamber of his heart, that perhaps Jem did not really love her, was gone, blown away like mist before a hard wind.
"You have never shirked your duties," Jem said. "And I know that you would have done what you could to save Tessa in the tea warehouse, whoever she was. But I could not help thinking that perhaps the reason you were so determined to save her was because you knew what she meant to me."
He tipped his head back, his smile incandescent.
"Did I guess correctly?
Or am I a thick-headed idiot?" "You're an idiot," said Will, and swallowed hard, past his dry throat. "But you are correct. I know what she means to you." Jem grinned. His happiness was printed all over his face, his eyes. Will thought he had never seen him look like this. He had always thought of Jem as a calm and peaceful presence, always thought that joy, like anger, was too extreme and human an emotion for him. He realized now that he had been quite wrong. Jem had simply not been happy like this before. Not since his parents had died, Will imagined. But Will had never considered it. He had dwelled on whether Jem was safe, whether he was surviving, but not if he was happy. "Jem is my great sin." Tessa had been right, he thought. He wanted her to break things off with Jem, whatever the cost. Now he realized he did not, could not.
"You might at least believe I know honor, honor and debt,"
he had said to Jem, and he had meant it. He owed Jem his life. He could not take from him the one thing Jem wanted more than anything else, even if it meant Will's own happiness. For Jem was not only someone to whom he owed a debt that could never be repaid, but as the covenant said, someone he loved,
as he loved his own soul. Jem looked not just happier, but stronger, Will thought, with healthy color in his cheeks, his back straight. I ought to apologize, Jem said. I was too severe regarding the Ifrit's den. I know you were merely seeking solace. Nah, you were right to have... I wasn't, Jem stood up. If I was harsh with you, it was because I cannot bear to see you treat yourself as if you were worth nothing. Whatever part you might act, to the contrary, I see you as you really are, my blood brother. Not just better than you pretend to be, but better than most people could hope to be. He placed a hand on Will's shoulder gently. You are worth everything, Will. Will closed his eyes. He saw the black, basalt council room, the two circles burning on the ground. Jem stepped from his circle to Will's, so they inhabited the same space, circumscribed by fire. His eyes had still been black then, wide in his pale face. Will remembered the words of the Parabatai oath. Whither thou goest, I will go. Where thou diest, will I die. And there will I be buried. The angel do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part thee and me. The same voice spoke again to him now. Thank you for what you did for Tessa, said Jem. Will could not look at Jem. He looked instead toward the wall, where the shadows blended together in relief, so that one could not tell where one boy ended and the other began. Thank you for watching, Brother Enoch. Pull shards of metal out of my back afterward, he said. Jem laughed. What else a Paravatai for? The council chamber was draped with red banners, slashed with black runes. Jem whispered to Tessa that they were runes of decision and judgment. They took their seats toward the front, in a row that also contained Henry, Gideon, Charlotte, and Will. Tessa had not spoken to Will since the day before. He had not been at breakfast, and had joined them in the courtyard late, still buttoning his coat as he ran down the stairs. His dark hair was disheveled, and he looked as if he had not slept. He seemed to be trying to avoid looking at Tessa, and she, in turn, avoided returning his gaze, though she could feel it flicking over her from time to time, like hot flecks of ash landing on her skin. Jem was a perfect gentleman. Their engagement was still secret, and other than smiling at her every time she looked at him, he behaved in no way out of the ordinary. As they settled themselves in their seats at the council, she felt him brush her arm with the knuckles of his right hand, gently, before moving his hand away. She could feel Will watching them from the end of the row they sat in. She did not look toward him. In seats on the raised platform at the chamber's center sat Benedict Lightwood, his eagle profile turned away from the mass of the council, his jaw set. Beside him sat Gabriel, who, like Will, looked exhausted and unshaven. He glanced once at his brother as Gideon entered the room, and then away as Gideon took his seat, deliberately among the shadow hunters of the Institute. Gabriel bit his lip and looked down at his shoes, but did not move from where he sat. She recognized a few more faces in the audience. Charlotte's aunt, Kalida, was there, as was Gaunt Aloysius Starkweather, despite, as he had complained, doubtless not being invited. His eyes narrowed as they fell on Tessa, and she turned back quickly to the front of the room.
We are here,
said Consul Wayland, when he had taken his place before the lectern with the Inquisitor seated to his left.
To determine to what extent Charlotte and Henry Branwell have been of assistance to the Clave during the past fortnight in the matter of Axel Mortmain, and whether, as Benedict Lightwood has put in a claim, the London Institute would be better off in other hands.
The Inquisitor rose. He was holding something that gleamed silver and black in his hand.
Then Charlotte Branwell, please come up to the lectern.
Charlotte got to her feet and climbed up the stairs of the stage. The Inquisitor lowered the mortal sword, and Charlotte wrapped her hands around the blade. In a quiet voice, she recounted the events of the past 2 weeks, searching for Mortmain in newspaper clippings and historical accounts, the visit to Yorkshire, the threat against the Herondales, discovering Jesse's betrayal, the fight at the warehouse, Nate's death. She never lied, though Tessa was conscious of when she left out a detail here or there. Apparently, the mortal sword could be gotten around, if only slightly. There were several moments during Charlotte's speech when the council members reacted audibly, breathing in sharply, shuffling their feet, most notably to the revelation of Jessamine's role in the proceedings.
I knew her parents,
Tessa heard from Charlotte's aunt Kalida, saying from the back of the room.
Terrible business, terrible.
And the girl, where is she now?
The Inquisitor demanded.
She is in the cells of the Silent City, said Charlotte, awaiting punishment for her crime. I informed the Consul of her whereabouts.
The Inquisitor, who had been pacing up and down the platform, stopped and looked at Charlotte keenly in the face.
You say this girl was like a daughter to you, he said, and yet you handed her over to the brothers willingly. Why would you do something like that?
The law is hard, said Charlotte, but it is the law.
Consul Wayland's mouth flicked up at the corner.
And here you said she'd be too soft on wrongdoers, Benedict,
he said.
Any comment?
Benedict rose to his feet. He had clearly decided to shoot his cuffs today, and they protruded snowy white from the sleeves of his tailored dark tweed jacket.
I do have a comment, he said. I wholeheartedly support Charlotte Branwell in her leadership of the Institute and renounce my claim on a position there.
A murmur of disbelief ran through the crowd. Benedict smiled pleasantly. The Inquisitor turned and looked at him in disbelief.
So you're saying, he echoed, that despite the fact these Shadow Hunters killed Nathaniel Grey or were responsible for his death, our only link to Mortmain, despite the fact that, once again, they harbored a spy beneath their roof, despite the fact that they still don't know where Mortmain is, you would recommend Charlotte and Henry Branwell to run this institute?
They may not know where Mortmain is, said Benedict, but they know who he is. As the great mundane military strategist Sun Tzu said in The Art of War, if you know your enemies and know yourself, you can win 100 battles without a single loss. We know now who Mortmain really is. A mortal man, not a supernatural being. A man afraid of death, a man bent on revenge for what he considers the undeserved murder of his family. Nor does he have compassion for downwelders. He utilized werewolves to help him build his clockwork army swiftly, feeding them drugs to keep them working around the clock, knowing the drugs would kill the wolves and ensure their silence. Judging by the size of the warehouse he used and the number of workers he employed, his clockwork army will be sizable. And judging by his motivations and the years over which he has refined his strategies for revenge, he is a man who cannot be reasoned with, cannot be dissuaded, cannot be stopped. We must prepare for a war, and that we did not know before.
The Inquisitor looked at Benedict, thin-lipped, as if he suspected that something untoward was going on but could not imagine what it might be.
Prepare for war? How do you suggest we do that? Building, of course, on all this supposedly valuable information the Branwells have acquired.
Benedict shrugged.
Well, that, of course, will be for the Council to decide over time. But Mortmain has tried to recruit powerful downworlders such as Woolsey Scott and Camille Belcourt to his cause. We may not know where he is, but we now know his ways. And we can trap him in that manner, perhaps by allying ourselves with some of the Downworld's more powerful leaders. Charlotte seems to have them all well in hand, don't you think?
A faint laugh ran around the council, but they were not laughing at Charlotte. They were smiling with Benedict. Gabriel was watching his father, his green eyes burning.
And the spy in the Institute, would you not call that an example of her carelessness? Said the Inquisitor.
Not at all, said Benedict. She dealt with the matter swiftly and without compassion.
He smiled at Charlotte, a smile like a razor.
I retract my earlier statement about her soft-heartedness. Clearly she is as able to deal justice without pity as any man.
Charlotte paled, but said nothing. Her small hands were very still on the sword. Consul Wayland sighed gustily.
I wish you had come to this conclusion a fortnight ago, Benedict, and saved us all this trouble.
Benedict shrugged elegantly.
I thought she needed to be tested, he said. Fortunately, she has passed that test. Wayland shook his head.
Very well, let us vote on it.
He handed what looked to be a cloudy glass vessel to the Inquisitor, who stepped down among the crowd and handed the vial to the woman sitting in the first chair of the first row. Tessa watched in fascination as she bent her head and whispered into the vial, then passed it to the man on her left. As the vial made its way around the room, Tessa felt Jem slip his hands into hers. She jumped, though her voluminous skirts, she suspected, largely hid their hands. She laced her fingers through his slim, delicate ones and closed her eyes.
I love him, I love him, I love him.
And indeed his touch made her shiver, though it also made her want to weep, with love, with confusion, with heartbreak, remembering. The look on Will's face when she had told him she and Jem were engaged, the happiness going out of him like a fire doused by rain. Jem drew his hand out of hers to take the vial from Gideon on his other side. She heard him whisper, Charlotte Branwell, before he passed the vial over her, to Henry on her other side. She looked at him, and he must have misconstrued the unhappiness in her eyes, because he smiled at her encouragingly.
It will be all right, he said. They'll choose Charlotte.
When the vial finished its travels, it was handed back to the Inquisitor, who presented it with a flourish to the consul. The consul took the vial, and placing it on the lectern before him, drew a rune on the glass with his steely. The vial trembled, like a kettle on the boil. White smoke poured from its open neck, the collected whispers of hundreds of shadow hunters. They spelled words out across the air.
Charlotte Branwell.
Charlotte dropped her hands from the mortal sword, almost sagging in relief. Henry made a whooping noise and threw his hat into the air. The room was filled with chatter and confusion. Tessa couldn't stop herself from glancing down the row at Will. He had slumped down in his seat, his head back, his eyes closed. He looked white and drained, as if this last bit of business had taken the remainder of his energy. A scream pierced the hubbub. Tessa was on her feet in moments, whirling around. It was Charlotte's Aunt Kalida screaming, her elegant gray head thrown back and her fingers pointing heavenward. Gasps ran around the room as the other shadow hunters followed her gaze. The air above them was filled with dozens, scores even, of buzzing black metal creatures, like enormous steel black beetles with coppery wings zipping back and forth through the air, filling the room with the ugly sound of metallic buzzing. One of the metal beetles dipped down and hovered in front of Tessa, just at eye level, making a clicking sound. It was eyeless, though there was a circular plate of glass in the flat front of its head. She felt Jem reach for her arm, trying to pull her away from it, but she jerked away impatiently, seized her hat off her head, and slammed it down on top of the thing, trapping it between her hat and the seat of her chair. It immediately set up an enraged, high-pitched buzzing.
Henry, she called. Henry, I've got one of those things.
Henry appeared behind her, pink-faced, and stared down at the hat. A small hole was opening in the side of the elegant gray velvet where the mechanical creature was tearing at it. With a curse, Henry brought his fist down hard, crushing the hat and the thing inside it against the seat. It buzzed and went still. Jem reached around and lifted the smashed hat gingerly. What was left under it was a scatter of parts, a metal wing, a shattered chassis, and broken off stumps of copper legs.
Ugh, said Tessa. It's so very bug-like.
She glanced up as another cry went through the room. The insectile creatures had come together in a black swirl in the center of the room. As she stared, they swirled faster and faster and then vanished, like black beetles sucked down a drain.
Sorry about the hat, said Henry. I'll get you another.
Bother the hat, said Tessa, as the cries of the angry council echoed through the room. She looked toward the center of the room. The consul stood with the glowing mortal sword in his hand, and behind him was Benedict, stone-faced, with eyes like ice.
Clearly we have bigger things to worry about.
It's sort of a camera, said Henry,
holding the bits of the smashed metal beetle creature on his lap as the carriage clopped toward home.
Without Jessamine, Nate, or Benedict, Mortmain must be out of reliable human spies who can report to him.
so he sent these things.
He poked at a shard. The bits were gathered together in a wreckage of Tessa's hat, held on his lap as they jounced along.
Benedict didn't look any too pleased to see those things, said Will. He must realize Mortmain already knows about his defection.
It was a matter of time, said Charlotte. Henry, can those things record sound, like a phonautograph, or simply pictures? They were flying around so quickly.
I'm not sure, Henry frowned. I shall have to examine the parts more closely in the crypt. I can find no shutter mechanism, but that does not mean...
He looked up at the uncomprehending faces focused on him and shrugged.
In any case, he said, perhaps it is not the worst thing for the Council to get a look at Mortmain's inventions. It is one thing to hear about them, another to see what he is doing. Don't you think, Lottie?
Charlotte murmured an answer, but Tessa didn't hear it. Her mind was caught up in going over a peculiar thing that had occurred just after she'd left the Council chambers and was waiting for the Branwell's carriage. Jem had just turned away from her to speak to Will when the flap of a black cloak caught her eye, and Aloysius Starkweather stalked up to her, his grizzled face fierce.
"Miss Gray," he barked, "that clockwork creature, the way it approached you."
Tessa had stood silently, staring, waiting for him to accuse her of something, though she could not imagine what.
"He's all right,"
he said abruptly, and at last, his Yorkshire accent seeming suddenly very pronounced.
"It didn't harm thee."
Slowly, Tessa had shaken her head.
"No, Mr. Starkweather, thank you kindly for your inquiry to my welfare, but no."
By then, Jem and Will had turned and were staring. As if aware he was drawing attention, Starkweather had nodded once, sharply, turned, and walked off, his ragged cloak blowing behind him. Tessa could make neither head nor tail of the whole business. She was just thinking of her brief time in Starkweather's head, and the astonishment he'd felt when he'd first seen her, when the carriage came to a jerking halt before the Institute. Relieved to be free of their cramped quarters, the Shadow Hunters and Tessa spilled out onto the drive. There was a gap in the grey cloud cover over the city, and lemon-yellow sunlight poured down, making the front steps glisten. Charlotte started toward them, but Henry stopped her, pulling her close with the arm that wasn't holding Tessa's destroyed hat. Tessa watched them, with the first glimmer of happiness she'd felt since yesterday. She had truly come to care for Charlotte and Henry, she realized, and she wanted to see them happy.
"What we should remember is that everything went as well as we could have hoped," Henry said, holding her tightly. "I'm so proud of you, darling."
Tessa would have expected a sarcastic comment from Will at this juncture, but he was staring off toward the gates. Gideon looked embarrassed, Jem as if he were pleased. Charlotte pulled away from Henry, blushing furiously and straightening her hat, but obviously delighted.
"Are you really, Henry?"
"Absolutely. Not only is my wife beautiful, she is brilliant, and that brilliance should be recognized."
"This," said Will, still looking off toward the gates, "is when Jessamine would have told you to stop because you were making her sick." The smile vanished from Charlotte's face.
"Poor Jessie."
But Henry's expression was uncharacteristically hard.
"She shouldn't have done what she did, Lottie. It's not your fault. We can only hope the Council deals with her leniently."
He cleared his throat.
"And let's have no more talk about Jessamine today, shall we? Tonight is for celebration. The Institute is still ours."
Charlotte beamed at him, with so much love in her eyes that Tessa had to look away toward the Institute. She blinked. High up in the stone wall, her eyes caught a flicker of movement. A curtain twitched away from the corner of a window, and she saw a pale face peering down. Sophie, looking for Gideon? She couldn't be sure. The face was gone as soon as it had appeared. Tessa dressed with special care that night, in one of the new gowns Charlotte had provided her, with a heart-shaped basque and a deeply cut rounded neckline, over which was pinned a chemisette of Mechlin lace. The sleeves were short and ruched, showing her long white arms, and she wore her hair in curls, pinned up and back, a coiffure interlaced with dark blue pansies. It was not until after Sophie had carefully fixed them in her hair that Tessa realized they were the color of Will's eyes, and wanted suddenly to pull them out, but of course she did nothing of the sort,
only thanked Sophie for her efforts, and complimented her sincerely on how prettily her hair had turned out. Sophie left before she did, to go and help Bridget in the kitchen. Tessa sat down automatically in front of the mirror to bite her lips and pinch her cheeks. She needed the color, she thought. She was unusually pale. The jade pendant was shoved down under the Mechlin lace, where it could not be seen. Sophie had looked at it as Tessa had dressed, but had not commented. She reached for the Clockwork Angel pendant and fastened it too, around her throat. It sat below the other pendant, just under her collarbones, and steadied her with its ticking. There was no reason she could not wear both, was there? When she emerged into the corridor, Jem was waiting for her. His eyes lit up when he saw her, and after a glance up and down the hall, he drew her toward him and kissed her on the mouth. She willed herself to melt into his kiss, to dissolve against him as she had done before. His mouth was soft on hers and tasted sweet, and his hands, when it cupped her neck, was strong and gentle. She moved closer to him, wanting to feel the beat of his heart. He drew back, breathless. "I didn't mean to do that." She smiled. "I think you did, James." "Not before I saw you," he said. "I meant only to ask if I could escort you to dinner, but you look so beautiful." He touched her hair. "I am afraid too much passion could start you shedding petals like a tree in autumn, though." "Well, you can," she said. "Escort me to dinner, that is." "Thank you." He ran his fingertips lightly across her cheekbones. "I thought I would wake up this morning and it would have been a dream, and you saying yes to me. But it wasn't, was it?" His eyes searched her face. She shook her head. She could taste tears in the back of her throat, and was glad for the kid gloves that hid the burn on her left hand. "I'm sorry you're getting such a bad bargain in me, Tessa," he said. "In years, I mean, shackling yourself to a dying man, when you're only 16. You're only 17. Plenty of time to find a cure," she whispered. "And we will find one. I will be with you forever." "Now that I believe," he said. "When two souls are as one, they stay together on the wheel. I was born into this world to love you, and I will love you in the next life, and the one after that." She thought of Magnus. "We are chained to this life by a chain of gold, and we dare not sever it for fear of what lies beyond the drop." She knew what he meant now. Immortality was a gift, but not one without its consequences. "For if I am immortal," she thought, "then I have only this one life. I will not turn and change as you do, James. I will not see you in heaven, or on the banks of the great river, or in whatever life lies beyond this one." But she did not say it. It would hurt him. And if there was anything she knew to be true, it was that a fierce, unreasoning desire lived in her to protect him from hurt, to stand between him and disappointment, between him and pain, between him and death, and fight them all back as Boadicea had fought back the advancing Romans. She reached up and touched his cheek instead, and he put his face against hers, her hair full of flowers, the color of Will's eyes. And they stood like that, clasped together, until the dinner bell rang a second time.
Bridget, who could be heard singing mournfully in the kitchen, had outdone herself in the dining room, placing candles in silver holders everywhere so the whole place glimmered with light. Cut roses and orchids floated in silver bowls on the white linen tablecloth. Henry and Charlotte presided at the head of the table. Gideon, in evening dress, sat with his eyes fixed on Sophie as she came in and out of the room, though she seemed to be studiously avoiding his glances. And beside him sat Will. "I love Jem. I am marrying Jem." Tessa had repeated it to herself all the way down the hall, but it made little difference. Her heart flipped sickeningly in her chest when she saw Will. She had not seen him in evening dress since the night of the ball, and, despite seeming pale and ill, he still looked ridiculously handsome in it.
"Is your cook always singing?" Gideon was asking in an awed tone,
as Jem and Tessa came in. Henry looked up and, on seeing them, smiled all over his friendly, freckled face.
"We were beginning to wonder where you two were," he began.
"Tessa and I have news,"
Jem burst out. His hand found Tessa's and held it. She stood frozen as three curious faces turned toward them. Four, if you counted Sophie, who had just walked into the room. Will sat where he was, gazing at the silver bowl in front of him. A white rose was floating in it, and he seemed prepared to stare at it until it went under. In the kitchen, Bridget was still singing one of her awful sad songs. The lyrics drifted in through the door.
"'Twas on an evening fair, I went to take the air. I heard a maid making her moan. Said, saw ye my father, or saw ye my mother, or saw ye my brother John? Or saw ye the lad that I love best, and his name it is Sweet William?"
I may murder her, Tessa thought. Let her make a song about that.
"Well, you have to tell us now," said Charlotte, smiling.
"Don't leave us dangling in suspense, Jem."
Jem raised their joined hands and said,
"Tessa and I are engaged to be married. I asked her, and she accepted me."
There was a shocked silence. Gideon looked astonished. Tessa felt rather sorry for him, in a detached sort of way. And Sophie stood holding a pitcher of cream, her mouth open. Both Henry and Charlotte looked startled out of their wits. None of them could have been expecting this, Tessa thought. Whatever Jessamine had said about Tessa's mother being a shadow hunter, she was still a downworlder, and shadow hunters did not marry downworlders. This moment had not occurred to her. She had thought somehow that they would tell everyone separately, carefully. Not that Jem would blurt it out in a fever of joyous happiness in the dining room. And she thought,
"Oh, please smile. Please congratulate us. Please don't spoil this for him. Please."
Jem's smile had only just begun to slip when Will rose to his feet. Tessa drew a deep breath. He was beautiful in evening dress. That was true, but he was always beautiful. There was something different about him now, though, a deeper layer to the blue of his eyes, cracks in the hard and perfect armor around himself that let through a blaze of light. This was a new Will, a different Will, a Will she had caught only glimpses of, a Will that perhaps only Jem had ever really known. And now she would never know him. The thought pierced her with a sadness, as if she were remembering someone who had died. He raised his glass of wine.
"I do not know two finer people," he said, "and could not imagine better news. May your lives together be happy and long."
His eyes sought Tessa's, then slid away from her, fastening on Jem.
"Congratulations, brother."
A flood of other voices came after his speech. Sophie set the pitcher down and came to embrace Tessa. Henry and Gideon shook Jem's hand, and Will stood, watching it all, still holding the glass. Through the happy babble of voices, only Charlotte was silent, her hand against her heart. Tessa bent worriedly over her.
"Charlotte, is everything all right?"
"Yes,"
Charlotte said, and then more loudly,
"yes, it is just, I have news of my own, good news."
"Yes, darling,"
said Henry.
"We've won the Institute back, but everyone does already know."
"No, not that, Henry. You..."
Charlotte made a hiccuping sound, half laughter, half tears.
"Henry and I are going to have a child. A boy. Brother Enoch told me. I didn't want to say anything before, but..."
The rest of her words were drowned out by Henry's incredulous whoop of joy. He lifted Charlotte entirely out of her seat and threw his arms around her.
"Darling, that's wonderful! Wonderful!"
Sophie gave a little shriek and clapped her hands. Gideon looked as if he were so embarrassed that he might conceivably die on the spot. And Will and Jem exchanged bemused smiles. Tessa could not help smiling as well. Henry's delight was infectious. He waltzed Charlotte across the room, and then back again before suddenly stopping, horrified that waltzing might be bad for the baby, and sat her down in the nearest chair. "Henry, I'm perfectly capable of walking," Charlotte said indignantly. "Even of dancing." "My darling, you are indisposed. You must remain abed for the next 8 months. Little Buford..." "I am not naming our child Buford. I don't care if it was your father's name. Or if it is a traditional Yorkshire name," Charlotte began in exasperation, when a knock sounded on the door, and Cyril poked his tousled head in. He stared at the scene of gaiety going on in front of him and said, hesitantly,
"Mr. Branwell, there's someone here to see you all."
Henry blinked.
"Someone to see us? But this is a private dinner, Cyril, and I did not hear the bell ring."
"No, she is Nephilim," said Cyril, "and she says it's very important. She will not wait."
Henry and Charlotte exchanged bewildered glances.
"Well, all right, then," said Henry at last. "Let her up, but tell her it will have to be quick."
Cyril vanished. Charlotte rose to her feet, smoothing down her dress and patting her disheveled hair.
"Aunt Kalida, perhaps?" she said in a puzzled voice. "I can't fathom who else."
The door opened again, and Cyril came in, followed by a young girl of about 15. She wore a black traveling cloak over a green dress. Even if Tessa had not seen her before, she would have known who she was instantly. Known her by her black hair, by the violet blue of her eyes, by the graceful curve of her white throat, the delicate angles of her features, the full swoop of her mouth. She heard Will draw a sudden, violent breath.
"Hello,"
said the girl, in a voice both surprisingly soft and surprisingly firm.
"I apologize for interrupting your dinner hour, but I had nowhere else to go. I am Cecily Herondale, you see. I have come to be trained as a shadow hunter."
"Mother, father, my Quaerv Vok. It's my 17th birthday today. I know that to write to you is to break the law. I know that I will likely tear this letter into pieces when it is finished, as I have done on all my birthdays past since I was 12. But I write anyway, to commemorate the occasion, the way some make yearly pilgrimages to a grave to remember the death of a loved one. For are we not dead to each other? I wonder if, when you woke this morning, you remembered that today, 17 years ago, you had a son. I wonder if you think of me, and imagine my life here at the Institute in London. I doubt you could imagine it. It is so very different from our house surrounded by mountains, and the great clear blue sky, and the endless green. Here everything is black and grey and brown, and the sunsets are painted in smoke and blood. I wonder if you worry that I am lonely, or as a mother always used to, that I am cold, that I have gone out into the rain again without a hat. No one here worries about those details. There are so many things that could kill us at any moment. Catching a chill hardly seems important. I wonder if you knew that I could hear you on that day you came for me when I was 12. I crawled under the bed to block out the sound of you crying my name. But I heard you. I heard Mother call for her Vok, her little one. I bit my hands until they bled, but I did not come down, and eventually Charlotte convinced you to go away. I thought you might come again, but you never did. Herondales are stubborn like that. I remember the great sighs of relief you would both give, each time the council came to ask me if I wished to join the Nephilim and leave my family, and each time I said no, and I sent them away. I wonder if you knew I was tempted by the idea of a life of glory, of fighting, and killing to protect as a man should. It is in our blood, the call to the Seraph and the Stealing, to marks and to monsters. I wonder why you left the Nephilim, Father. I wonder why Mother chose not to ascend and to become a shadow hunter. Is it because you found them cruel or cold? I have not found them so. Charlotte especially is kind to me, little knowing how much I do not deserve it. Henry is mad as a brush, but a good man. He would have made Ella laugh. There is little good to be said about Jessamine, but she is harmless. As little as there is good to say about her, there is as much good to say about Jem. He is the brother father always thought I should have. Blood of my blood, though we are no relation. Though I might have lost everything else, at least I have gained one thing in his friendship. And we have a new addition to our household too. Her name is Tessa. A pretty name, is it not? When the clouds used to roll over the mountains from the ocean, that grey is the colour of her eyes.
The Infernal Devices, Book 2, Clockwork Prince, was written by Cassandra Clare and read by Heather Lind and Ed Westwick. It was recorded by Erica Weintraub at Simon & Schuster Studios in New York and Mitchell Lindskog at Point 360 West in Los Angeles. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Christina Zarafanidis. The Infernal Devices, Book 2, Clockwork Prince, was produced and directed by Carol Shapiro. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Clockwork Prince is available in hardcover from Margaret K. McElderry Books. Other titles by Cassandra Clare from Simon & Schuster Audio, The Infernal Devices, Book 1, Clockwork Angel, read by Jennifer Ely, and The Mortal Instruments, Book 4, City of Fallen Angels, read by Molly C. Quinn and Ed Westwick.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.